Rita levou meu sorriso, e o sorriso dela meu assunto. Levou junto com ela o que me é de direito, arrancou-me do peito e tem mais. Levou seu retrato, seu trapo, seu prato, que papel, uma imagem de São Francisco e um bom disco de Noel. A Rita matou nosso amor de vingança, nem herança deixou. Não levou um tostão porque não tinha não, mas causou perdas e danos. Levou os meus planos, meus pobres enganos, os meus 20 anos, o meu coração. E além de tudo, me deixou mudo, um violão.
Welcome to the Circumference podcast series. I'm Montana Ray, and today I have the honor and the pleasure of talking with Monica de la Torre. Monica, I'd like to start by asking when you began translating.
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent question, because I don't get asked that too often, and I never thought of myself as a translator. I mean, I always knew I wanted to be a writer, but being a translator is not something that you mm-hmm. you don't dream of becoming a translator, because right. they're figures that are normally eclipsed, right, by the people who they translate. So there's you don't grow up with role models for them. There was one translator who looms large in my mind, and that was Elliot Weinberger, because of Octavio Paz. So mm-hmm. Octavio Paz was so huge in Mexico that whenever people referred to Elliot, it was like, oh, Elliot Weinberger. And you know, I love him to death. He's been an amazing figure in my life. But I think I started translating simply because when I was in the program at Columbia, people had no way of talking about what I was doing. Now, it sounds really pretentious. It's not like I felt like by translating people who I was reading, then perhaps they would be able to read me better, but that's not the point, because it took a really long time. But it was just so clear to me that people had no idea of where I was coming from. I mean, people would say like, whoa, your work sounds just like Octavio Paz. It's clearly, it's not related to Octavio Paz in the least, although he was a very influential figure for me when I was like 16. I was trying to write Octavio Paz poems. We all did that, but my poetry later was not that. And or people would say Vallejo. And Vallejo and Paz are very different poets. But Vallejo had just been translated by Clayton Eshleman, so people were aware of him. And so they would mention Vallejo, Neruda, who else? Lorca. Oh, yeah. Vallejo, Paz, Neruda, and Lorca. And that was it. That was it. So it's just kind of sad to see your frame of reference shrunk. Like, you just see this shrunken version of where you, of the space that you feel you want to inhabit. That was really it. I just felt like, what happened? Yeah. I mean, and you know it because you've traveled so much and you've done so much cross-cultural stuff, but it's shocking. Right. It's a real eye-opening experience. Now, it wasn't unfamiliar to me because I spent a lot of summers in Connecticut visiting my family. Mm-hmm. My mother has 9 brothers and sisters, so there's 10 in the family, of which she was the only person to leave not only her home state, but the country.
Wow.
Everybody else was in Connecticut. So when I was growing up, it was not uncommon to meet people who said, like, do you have cats and dogs in Mexico? Whoa, you watch TV? How do you know that song? You know the Beatles? How do you know the Beatles? You live in Mexico. So I was aware of that, but when I was beginning to write, I wasn't expecting writers
right
to be so clueless.
Right.
So I started translating someone who then I realized was being translated by Delius Merwin, so I just went like, oh, maybe I'll just like abandon that project. It's completely pointless to even try. And the poet is Jaime Sabines, mm-hmm. who is a really interesting poet. And there was a reason. I mean, I was always strategic without knowing it, like in the sense that I felt Octavio Paz was so easy to translate, right? Because it's always these abstractions, these yeah. like elemental words. I mean, Not to say that Eliot's translations are not amazing, because they are, but Octavio Paz's poetry, or at least the poetry that's traveled more, and the poetry that people like to cite, and the poetry that people that sticks on people's minds is sticking for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't pose that many translation problems.
Mm.
And there was this other poet who was younger than Paz, like maybe 15 years younger than Paz, who stood for colloquial vernacular poetry. In Mexico, they used to say he was the poet of the pinche piedra.
Mm.
And pinche, there you have like the swearing, you know, cuss word, and it's very colloquial. And it was very funny.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, which is more local, and of course,
mm-hmm.
is more difficult to translate because it's full of what I consider to be Mexican humor. That was difficult to translate, and I felt like that other side that was more local instead of universal had to be seen.
Yeah.
So that's why I chose him. But then Merwin translated him, and I actually thought it was pretty amazing because people responded to that work.
Yeah.
And I wasn't expecting it. And then just that led to other things, and I was asked by the America Society to help out with a program that they were doing. They invited, this is pathetic, this is so sad. They invited major translators to read English versions of the poems by these, I think it was like 10 Mexican poets who they were bringing to read at America Society. But the translators didn't have time to work on the translators didn't have time to translate. So they were just like the mouthpieces. They would just read the English versions even though they hadn't worked on them. And so I was invited to be the ghost translator.
Weird.
Of the poems of this woman who I knew in Mexico, Maria Baranda.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really weird because I was at the reading, I was sitting in the audience, and this other translator who got paid was reading my versions. But what was good about it is that I really learned a lot, because this person I really respected, and I was terrified that he would be very judgmental and critical of my work. So I went, I worked so hard on those translations.
Right.
I really did. I mean, I'd never worked harder on anything, not even things that I had written.
Right.
So it worked, I think. And then that just opened more doors, and then I got asked to do something else, and then I realized, oh, you know, here I have like, I had a little collection of translations of works by women poets, four different ones.
Mm-hmm.
At the time I was working at the Poetry Society of America.
Mm-hmm.
I was editing the newsletter. Don't ask me why, because I'd been in New York for a year, and I had no idea what the symbols meant, or
right.
American punctuation. It really was a disaster.
That's hilarious.
It was a disaster. I all the time I kept thinking, why did they pick me to do this job? But I needed the money, so I couldn't turn it down. And so then they said, oh, you're Mexican, why don't you write a little article on Mexican poetry? I said, okay, sure. And so I wrote an essay on these four women poets, and then I translated them, and then someone saw that. And then I got asked to do something else, and then it just snowballed. But when you start doing work that people want you to do,
mm-hmm.
you can easily fall into a trap.
Mm-hmm.
The trap being, okay, so it turns out there is interest, but what does this interest in this other poetry mean, and how is it that people are packaging it?
Right.
Packaging it, you know. And so then I noticed, so it's cool if I translate women poets.
Yeah.
Not that, obviously, I really admired the work of these women poets, but I could have just easily taken that path and not really had to, I wasn't forced to, I mean, if I had gone that way, it would have been really easy for me
mm-hmm.
to then do a number of anthologies
mm-hmm.
of like 12 women poets.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure I subscribe to the idea that something's valuable just because you're bundling
mm-hmm.
Things that seem PC and
mm-hmm.
that perhaps,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's loaded. I've never thought that approach is the best one. Then after I worked at the Poetry Society of America, I was working at the Mexican Cultural Institute, and we would do shows, and It's like six Mexican painters. Like, who cares?
Right.
Like, you need context, you know, and what painters, and you need specifics, specificity. Just because they're women doesn't mean that the work is dialogue.
I know what you mean. Well, and it's like you were saying earlier with reducing a country's
right.
poetry. It's like being at the grocery store. Like, get your Mexican mm-hmm. poet here. Poet from Iraq here. And like, you
exactly.
know, I feel like that is, it's very frustrating. It's reductive. It's not
reductive.
Critical.
Exactly.
It's not thoughtful.
Yeah, exactly. So then what happened after that is that there was a poet who I had always adored, Gerardo Denis.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's when I went, you know, I really want to do this. And no one's asking for it.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody wants to read this work. It's really difficult. But I'm going to do it. And so I just kept doing it. And then eventually I had a little collection. And there was support in Mexico to promote the work. Because he was seen as someone who was
mm-hmm.
really like a giant.
Mm-hmm.
Who was completely unknown abroad because nobody was translating him. Because there was a myth around him that he was untranslatable.
Would you read one of your translations of Gerardo Denis? I had earmarked Muse, the translation of Musa, which appears in the multilingual anthology Reversible Monuments, Contemporary Mexican Poetry, which you co-edited.
Okay. Musa. Cuerpo dechado de dioscurismo sobre la mediocridad y liconia de este verso. ¿Quién va a poder hallar dos mugrosas anacrucis en nubes vistas de canto? Porque el mundo es redondo, eso sí. Aún dentro de la ciudad se nota, por la tarde. Cuando un vigía cínico pregona las exageraciones del cacareo y le preguntan con gestos que qué anunciaba, ¿quién va a conservar el humor si durante las ráfagas suenan como un ajedrez marmóreo en su caja las terpsícores y melpómenes dando traspiés de oso borracho en la sentina? Muchacha, ya sabes, aunque el derecho de pernada con agravantes lo alaben los perspicaces, por término medio, 73% de cada noche de amor, de las sublimes, se pasa durmiendo. Y es incómodo. Okay, so the translation is Muse. Typical dioscuric body above the heliconian mediocrity of this line. Who can find two lousy anacrises in clouds seen askew? For the world is round, certainly. It's apparent even in the city. In the afternoon. When a cynical watchman calls attention to the excesses of hawking and people's faces question what he's announcing, who can keep their humor if while the wind howls that terpsichores and melpomenes sound like marble chess pieces in a box, stumbling like drunken bears on a boat spilge? Girl, you know it. Even if the aggravated droit de seigneur is praised by the shrewd, on average 73% of a love night of the sublime ones is spent sleeping, and it's uncomfortable.
You're listening to the Circumference podcast series. I'm Montana Ray, and that was Monica de la Torre reading from her translations of Gerardo Denis. Monica, can you tell me about your relationship with Denis?
I kind of stumbled on his work when I was in college. He had a book called Amor y Occidente, but Occidente, the word for West, was misspelled, so it had an X instead of two
mm-hmm.
C's. So Occidente, so it kind of pointed to oxidation or something,
mm-hmm.
and I was just very perplexed by the
mm-hmm.
by the spelling. So I bought the book, and then I loved it. Okay, but here's what happened. I couldn't understand a word he was saying. And it seemed like it was the kind of word that those words sort of sonically had an effect that seemed to be coherent with what the main effect of the poem was, even though I wasn't sure of what exactly was being said.
Mm-hmm.
Often because it's multilingual, so he'll have, I mean, right now I read, there's a little part of it in French, but
mm-hmm.
in other poems he'll have Hungarian, Japanese,
mm-hmm.
Greek,
mm-hmm.
Latin, and he doesn't translate it, he just leaves it there.
Mm-hmm.
So I was always like in love with the texture of the poems. And then when I dug in and like did a little research, the poems just unfolded and
mm-hmm.
they just went in these amazing directions. I love the fact that they weren't corny.
Mm-hmm.
There's something that happens in Spanish, and here I am making general statements and lumping things together, but I think the language and the tradition kind of lends itself to a certain approach, to a certain lyrical approach that sometimes is not terribly rigorous.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very frustrated with that.
Mm-hmm.
It's very prevalent in Mexican poetry. There's also like this kind of watered down surrealist streak where you'll just like, people get a little carried away by the sound of something. They don't examine exactly what the strategy is, whether there's a metaphor there. People have mixed metaphors, and one metaphor after another, after another, after another. And so it might sound beautiful, but I'm missing like some conceptual rigor there.
Mm-hmm.
And so the niece is the exact opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Like he, I mean, first of all, like a lot of his poems are making fun of poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something that I think, I mean, maybe they're not, they have a very ironic position before what the poetic, the status of the poetic is. And I like that because I don't think it's possible to be a poet in this day and age and not be slightly critical of what that means,
mm-hmm.
or what that entails. So I tend to respond to work that does that.
Undercuts it.
Yeah, yeah. And so, and it also, it kind of reminded me of Huidobro,
mm-hmm.
in terms of how it's this very deliberate attempt to write anti-poetry, poetry that's not the poetic poetry by poetic poets.
Mm-hmm.
So I see Huidobro there, I see Nicanor Parra,
mm-hmm.
who I also love, but then something else that's different, which is kind of like language poetry in a sense. So I started translating him, and then it turns out that I met these people in Mexico who were completely devoted to him,
mm-hmm.
and they had a letterpress publishing house, very small, and they loved the idea of me translating him, and so then I met Denise.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I went to Mexico, I would go to this workshop, and they had the presses there, and the printing press, and Denise was there, and he loved whiskey, so we drank a lot of whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
And we developed this amazing friendship.
Yeah.
Over the course of like 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, he's kind of old school. He's not that old,
mm-hmm.
and when I met him, he was in his mid-60s.
Mm-hmm.
But he kind of had these like affectations of like an older man, so
mm-hmm.
he could only be reached on the phone. He wasn't doing email. Couldn't fax him. He had a double life also because his name's a pseudonym.
Right.
And so by the time I met him, his family knew exactly what was going on. But it was just weird, like, because his name is Juan, no? Juan Almela.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'd be talking, if you called him, you would have to ask for Juan Almela. It was just bizarre. No, you just felt... It just felt weird. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I kind of relied on my friends at Taller Editorial, which is the printing press, the letterpress place. I relied on them for
mm-hmm.
my social interactions with Denise. And yeah, that went on for a while. And then, like we say in Spanish, le perdí la pista. We've
mm-hmm.
kind of not been in touch
mm-hmm.
for a while. But very, very, very fruitful. And the most important part for me is that he really taught me writing.
Really,
I think just actually doing the work.
Yeah, the cheapest MFA. It's
the cheapest MFA. Totally. Do you agree?
I agree.
Could you speak to the specific ways that being a translator became a learning process for you?
I mean, the main thing for me is that I didn't have to worry about self-expression.
Right.
So it's, yeah, and then there's also this sense of like a real responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
So like when
mm-hmm.
writing, you have an idea of what it is that you want to do,
mm-hmm.
but it's not palpable, it's not tangible until you actually put something down, and then that thing that you've put down kind of eclipses what it is that you had in your mind, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the standard keeps fluctuating.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so, I mean, and that thing that you wanted, or that hope or aim or that goal that you want to attain is so abstract,
mm-hmm.
when there's no writing, that it, and even when there is writing, that it's kind of difficult to tell whether you should keep going with something, whether it's done or it's not done, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
I always struggled with that. Like,
mm-hmm.
is a poem done?
Mm-hmm.
How much do I need to belabor this? And with a translation, like, there's always this sense, you always have a very clear goal,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And if something's not working, at some point you're able to see it clearly, more clearly than if something's not working when you're on, with, when it's your own writing. I do think that after a while you can see it, you can trick yourself into thinking that something's done.
Yeah.
But with a translation, you can do that less, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So there was that. There was also, like, the other thing you said, which is really interesting, especially with Denise, is that his poems are so like, they're so populated by references to everything,
mm-hmm.
ranging from science to philosophy to literature. So just working on one series of poems would lead to 10 authors that I felt like I wanted to read.
Mm-hmm.
So that was amazing. And then the other thing that I think is peculiar, perhaps just to my case, is that I felt like I was learning English.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If I had been translating into Spanish, mm-hmm. it would have been a complete different experience, because even though, like you, I would have had to be more attentive,
mm-hmm.
right, and really examine the meanings of words and stuff, I would have felt there's a degree of comfort that I used to have in Spanish,
mm-hmm.
that I'd never had in English. So with English, I really need to push myself to find something that to other people read as accurate.
Yeah.
And so in doing that, I learned all these words and turns of phrase that I wasn't necessarily that familiar with.
Monica, I'd like to ask you to read again from your work, from Acúfanos, Instrucciones para subir un puente peatonal o de cómo contemplar las vías rápidas en el DF. And from talk shows, would you read How to Look at Mexican Highways?
Okay, let's see. Actually, you have an amazing eye, because this is the only poem in that book, and up till very recently, that I ever translated. A ver, Instrucciones para subir un puente peatonal o de cómo contemplar las vías rápidas en el DF. 1. Diríjase hacia alguna parte. 1.1. Olvide quien lo espera. 1.2. Si llega tarde, ya explicará la demora. 1.3. Culpe al tráfico. Solo usted sabe que anda a pie. 2. No mire el piso. Vea lo que las casas esconden al exterior de sus muros. 2.1. Tinacos, tanques de agua. 2.2. Cables. 2.2.1. Cables transmisores de los rostros y voces de otros a los monitores de la televisión. 2.2.2. Cables que permiten la transmisión de luz y el enfriamiento de refrigeradores. 2.2.3. Ondas transmisoras de sonido radiofónico. 3. Evite los espectaculares, grave distracción. 4. Mira qué tan rápido puede subir y bajar las escaleras. Compare esa velocidad con la de los autos que ve pasar. 5. Cuando se canse, deténgase al centro del puente peatonal. 5.1. Mire hacia abajo. 5.2. Trate de mirar al frente, trate de trazar el perfil de la ciudad. 5.2.1. Mire hacia abajo de nuevo. 5.2.2. No suelte el barandal. 5.2.3. Quédese ahí un poco más. No sabe quién lo espera. 6. Entre los barandales, observe los recorridos de los demás. 7. Ponga atención. 7.1. Usted no es los otros. 7.2. Ellos no son ellos. 8. Como los autos, son mónadas yendo a alguna parte. 9. Por algo las mónadas se desplazan. 10. El deseo es federación. Okay. Thank you. How to look at Mexican highways. 1. You are not going anywhere. 1.1. No one is waiting for you. 1.2. In case someone is waiting for you, you can always explain the delay later. 1.3. Blame it on the traffic. No one else knows that you chose to walk. 2. Don't look at the pavement. Look at the things that you don't see when you're indoors. 2.1. Water towers. 2.2. Cables. 2.2.1. Cables bringing other people's voices and faces onto TV monitors. 2.2.2. Cables bringing electricity to light bulbs and refrigerators. 2.3. Laundry on clotheslines. 2.4. Empty cans of food. 2.4.1. With flowers growing out of them. 2.4.2. With cactuses growing out of them. 3. Feel the waves surrounding you. 3.1. Waves bringing other people's voices to the speakers of your sound system. 3.2. Waves of street sounds. 4. Measure how fast you can run up and down staircases. Compare that to the speed of the cars driving by. 5. When you tire, stand in the middle of the overpass. 5.1. Look down. 5.2. Try to look ahead. Attempt to delineate the city skyline. 5.2.1. If there's too much pollution, look down again. 5.2.2. Hold on tighter to the rail. 5.2.3. Stay there a bit longer. Remember, no one is waiting for you. 5.2.4. You're not going anywhere. 6. Through the rails, you will see stories unfolding on the street. 6.1. Pay attention. 6.2. You are not they. 6.3. They are not they. 6.3.1. They are 1 plus 1 plus 1 indefinitely. 7. You're surrounded by monads going somewhere. 8. There is a purpose to their movement. 9. Desire is a federacy.
You're listening to Circumference podcast series. That was Monica de la Torre reading from Acúfanos, a book printed by Taller de Etoria. The poem was Instrucciones para subir un puente peatonal o de cómo contemplar las vías rápidas en el DF. And we followed that with How to Look at Mexican Highways from talk shows published by Switchback Books. So, Monica, which came first? The Spanish or the English?
I first wrote the poem in Spanish because a friend of mine who's an artist, Silvia Gruner, was preparing a show at a museum in Mexico City, and it was called Circuito Interior. Mm-hmm. And Circuito Interior is a very beautiful phrase because it means interior circuit, but it's really the most prosaic thing in Mexico City. Mm-hmm. The Circuito Interior is just this road. It's like a highway that you take. And it's not terribly pretty, Circuito Interior. It's a nightmare, actually. It's full of traffic and stuff. But she called it Circuito Interior because she liked the resonances, the metaphorical content. She liked the literal meaning. So she invited me to write a poem for it, and I thought of this poem. I really don't remember how I arrived at it or why I thought that one. I guess I was trying to do maybe the same thing of like inhabiting public space and just like roaming the city and having it be all about like an exterior, right? It's not about interior, my interiority at all. And this desire to see other people, but all you're seeing is facades and movement. And so when I read it right now, I realized, because I hadn't really thought that much about this in a while, but I think I like the Spanish more because just the title, like Instrucciones para subir un puente peatonal o de cómo contemplar las vías rápidas del DF.
Yeah.
So, right? And then in English, it's like it's the version for tourists.
Yes, I know. I laughed at that too. I was like, does she think we don't know?
Right. I got rid of DF, Mexico City, and just like gave it, okay, so you can't understand the difference between DF and Mexico City and the rest, but just like look at this Mexican highway. And the Mexican one, the poem in Spanish is, I find it like more absurd. And have you ever read Cortázar's Instructions?
Like how to climb a staircase.
Yes, exactly. Yes. I love those.
Yeah.
This is kind of related to that.
Yeah, and I feel like you don't get that reference as much
in the English.
The gesture in the English is like, it's kind of, yes, it is for tourists, but at the same time, there's a denial. Like, oh, you want me to perform like my Mexicanness? You want to see a Mexican highway? Well, here's what it is. And it's exactly the opposite of what you would expect because there's no trace of anything folkloric or regional. Right.
And right. So there are definitely certain words like what's the word for the gasoline?
Yeah.
Like stuff like that is very local, you know.
Right,
very
local, very Mexico City.
Yeah.
And in English, I mean, all you're getting perhaps that is kind of picturesque might be the cactuses. like the empty cans of food with flowers growing out of them or with cactuses growing out of them.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you travel there, you see, oh, everyone's repurposing their trash and using
mm-hmm.
it as flower pots.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe that is consistent with what people expect, but the rest is like not what you would expect at all. And the Spanish, you would know that already, so it's more,
mm-hmm.
yeah, I think it's more humorous. Mm-hmm. And in English, it's more of a fuck you, I think.
Yeah.
It's so bossy.
It is.
Yeah. It's bossy. Yeah.
Monica is senior editor at Bomb Magazine. You're in a position to make highbrow culture in New York. Now, words like monster truck races and Velveeta cheese pop out at me in your poetry. Would you talk a little bit about the mix of highbrow and lowbrow culture?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think that was one of the things that were really interesting to me about writing in English.
Mm-hmm.
Because in Spanish, at the time, it's changed. I mean, I've been here almost 20 years, which is a really long time. And things have changed a lot
mm-hmm.
in Spanish writing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, or Spanish language writing and in what's being produced now in Mexico City or places like Argentina. I'm not sure about other places, but I'm sort of familiar with the scene in Argentina and part of the scene in Chile and Mexico City. And so people are doing this kind of mashup and more like clashing of highbrow and pop culture much more than they were 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But when in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
So when I moved here and I realized that all that was possible in English, it was so exciting to
yeah.
me that I couldn't resist it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a much more permeable. I just feel like language is just so much more permeable, or the poetic discourse and literary discourse just can. It's kind of like voracious, like anything can go into it.
Yeah.
And in Spanish, I perceived that the gates were like much taller and guarded, and it was
mm-hmm.
like you couldn't put prosaic stuff into a poem because then it wasn't a poem and people
mm-hmm.
and even if it was prosaic, like when I was talking about the Pinche Piedra and
mm-hmm.
Jaime Sabines,
mm-hmm.
it was still kind of essential. It wasn't
mm-hmm.
like, you know, mentioning TV programs or brands or
mm-hmm.
or any of that. So for me, that was like liberating and very playful, and it just like opened up the tools that were at my disposal
yeah.
when I was writing in English. Not only that, I think a lot of it also had to do with the fact that it's kind of like this lingua franca
mm-hmm.
amongst people in the all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a way of expanding my vocabulary literally by
mm-hmm.
just using all those words.
You mean the brand
and
names
allusions
and
yeah,
okay.
and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like yeah, maybe a very subtle act of appropriation
mm-hmm.
of something that is imposing itself onto world culture,
mm-hmm.
and so by claiming it, you know, yeah, like let's say. Lyrics and songs,
mm-hmm.
and maybe you don't see it that much in that book, but I do it in public domain.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the airwaves of half of the planet
mm-hmm.
have songs in English,
mm-hmm.
and so why not use them in poems in English?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if I did that with Spanish words, it would be different. And the registers of lyrics in Spanish are also different. They're not as poppy,
mm-hmm.
even if it's pop music.
Right.
Because they're always aspiring to be poetic.
yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the other stuff, I don't know. I mean, so now I'm more interested in doing that in Spanish than in English
mm-hmm.
to a degree, because Spanish is calling for it a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think it's a very ripe time to be experimenting with. It's not even experimentation nowadays. I mean, it's so old.
Mm-hmm.
But the poetry world in Mexico, in some ways, is so conservative. Like, it's not conservative formally.
Mm-hmm.
It's very experimental formally.
Mm-hmm.
Like, anything goes.
Right.
But thematically
mm-hmm.
and discursively, it's still super staid.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like that's the intervention that needs to happen in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Interesting.
Yeah.
Can you say a little bit more about why you might write a poem in Spanish instead of English?
In those two books, in Talk Shows and Acúfenos,
mm-hmm.
the idea was, actually, that was the way I decided what to do. If something was in Spanish and it couldn't be translated into English easily,
mm-hmm.
then it had to be in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And if it was like if it had these a turbulence and like ambiguity and indeterminacy in Spanish, then that was the language I was supposed to be using. And if it was easily translatable, then I wasn't that interested in it. I mean, there was work that, like, for me, the interest was like exploiting what the language itself was offering, and that's what determined what I was doing with each poem. And in talk shows, it was the same thing. Like when I was writing the poems for workshop, they had to be in English because I was doing something with the English that I could only do in English, and I couldn't do it in Spanish. And that, I mean, and maybe anybody could prove me wrong, because I'm sure they can look at the poems and go like, what are you talking about? That doesn't hold. But in my head, it makes sense. And that was the determinant aspect. And I think it has psychological reasons. I mean, I won't get into them. They're boring. But in a way, I was experimenting with the idea of mimetizing or camouflage. Or like, I wanted to write poems in English that didn't announce that I wasn't, that English wasn't my, what is it? I mean, it's my mother tongue, but it's not my native tongue.
Right.
So I wanted to write something in English that could pass. And passing was
That's fascinating.
Was what was interesting to me.
Yeah.
And the same in Spanish. Like, the poems in Spanish totally passed for Spanish. I never had a problem with Spanish, actually, because English never interfered with it.
Right.
But I didn't want to, like, start putting English just because I was living in New York when I wrote those poems. So then it's like, oh, so now I'm going to pepper the poems with English phrases.
Yeah.
Like, that just seemed repellent to me.
Yeah.
So the way culture in New York filtered into the poems is actually kind of oblique. So you have like references to the Wooster Group and Eugene O'Neill and stuff, and that's cool, but I was going to put a word in English. But then what happened with the second book in English, Public Domain, is that then I started using Spanish to kind of to kind of chide readers in a way, and it was also political. It was like I considered it an intervention. So people, and then that was paired with people's expectation of like, oh, you're Mexican, well, why don't you read in Spanish? Like, you should, you know, you're Mexican. If you're Mexican, you should always read some poems in Spanish at your readings. It's like, fuck you. Like, what, you want me to perform?
Right.
See, the minute it becomes like satisfying an expectation that other people have, because otherwise, like, what am I? Like, if people find that problematic, but I find it more problematic to actually satisfy their urge to see me perform my Mexicanness or my Mexican identity. So I started using Spanish in Public Domain. Like, there's this piece that is all in Spanish, but it's designed for a monolingual person to understand it. And it has all these P's that pop on the microphone. And so you're sitting there, and then all of a sudden you hear the word vigilantes. And it's about vigilantes and people at the border sitting there with their shotguns trying to, like, trap illegal immigrants.
Yeah.
And so I read that, and people really like it somehow, which is funny to me. And then there's another piece in Spanish that's all made with sí and no, and all kinds of permutations of sí and no that actually spell different phrases. And so I did that, and I thought, you know, and I was cool with it. And then I started taking that further, and there was a poetics conference at Columbia hosted by the English department, and people put me on this panel on globalization or globalism or something, global culture, whatever it was. And there was no one except me on that panel that had anything to say about a different culture. And I just thought, this is what I'm going to do. So I decided to just, like, so I spoke on concrete poets. And I said it was all about how deliberate their attempt was to make translation possible with the concrete poems. Because they wanted to have them penetrate the world arena, right? And so the ratio or the quote there, it's more driven by the eye and not by the ear, therefore it's more easily exchanged and commodified, and that's why everybody could read the concrete poems and they became so popular, because in translation not much was lost, or that was the ideal.
Yeah.
Because of course a lot gets lost in translation anyway. But so, and then when Haroldo de Campos starts writing the Galaxias and those like super long poems that are all about colloquialisms and language play and very regional stuff. Then when I switched to writing about that, I switched to Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And I spoke in Spanish for like 6 minutes or something. And people in the audience were just looking at me like,
wow.
And then I went back to English. And then people had all kinds of comments that were fascinating. Like one person came up to me and said, you know, what you were saying was so fascinating, but when you spoke in Spanish, you were it was so real. It was just so, you know, and so they, of course, typical.
Yeah.
It's like I speak in Spanish, then my authentic self comes out, you know.
Oh my God, yeah.
Which is, you know, he meant well.
Right, which is better
just,
than, right.
But it was just such a telling comment. And then
mm-hmm.
some people got the other point. It's like I'm saying, like,
mm-hmm.
oh, so you want, okay, so you want to hear about global cultures or the other in only in the terms that you're equipped to understand. So therefore, I need to get rid of otherness and speak
mm-hmm.
to you in English in this in the terms that you're already equipped to hearing, but then you're not really accessing otherness because
mm-hmm.
all you can receive and take in is what you already know,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I refused to do that, and I spoke in Spanish. And so some people got that, and then some people thought I was criticizing concrete poetry, and it was fascinating. But so I've done that. I think I want to continue doing stuff in that direction. What I really don't want to do is put the Spanish there for decorative effect.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And that's a temptation because
mm-hmm.
it sounds pretty, you know.
Mm-hmm.
When I do it, it's like, whoa, I even like it. You
mm-hmm.
know? Or when other people do it, I really like it. But there has to be something else going on, not just the mere
mm-hmm.
texture.
Monica teaches an amazing class at Columbia University on Latin American poetry called Traditions of Rupture. I'm going to share a little bit of that experience.
Morte e vida severina. Monólogo final. O Carpina fala com retirante que esteve de fora sem tomar parte em nada. Severino retirante, deixe agora que lhe diga. Eu não sei bem a resposta da pergunta que fazia. Se não vale mais saltar fora da ponte e da vida. Nem conheço essa resposta, sequer mesmo que lhe diga. É difícil defender só com palavras a vida. Ainda mais quando ela é esta que vê, Severina. Mas se responder não pude a pergunta que fazia, ela, a vida, a respondeu com sua presença viva. E não há melhor resposta que o espetáculo da vida. Vê-la desfiar seu fio, que também se chama vida. Ver a fábrica que ela mesma teimosamente se fabrica. Vê-la brotar como há pouco em nova vida explodida. Mesmo quando é assim pequena a explosão, como a ocorrida. Mesmo quando é uma explosão como a de há pouco, Franzina. Mesmo quando é a explosão de uma vida severina.
You were listening to a recording of João Cabral Gimelo Neto, who is a Brazilian poet that Mônica de la Torre introduced her students to in Traditions of Rupture. It was one of my favorite books of the class, Education by Stone, translated by Richard Zenith. But that poem, which was Morte y Vida Severina, does not appear in the book, but is translated by Elizabeth Bishop and appears in the October 1963 poetry magazine. So I'll post the link for that. Now, Mônica, Cabral de Melo Neto stopped writing after he went blind. Would you stop writing if you lost your sense of hearing?
If I lost my sense of hearing, no, I don't think I would stop writing. No. And if I lost my ability to see, maybe I would.
Really? Oh, I was so wrong. I was 100% wrong.
Yeah, because hearing, it's like so, I mean, like when you read poetry,
mm-hmm.
you're really hearing it in your head, right? Like we have such an ability to conjure sound in our heads.
Right.
And I feel like, at least for me, I don't have that capacity to conjure images in my head without outside simulation.
Mm-hmm. Especially in computer day and age where it's just like so easy to move things around and it's pretty, you know, the labor side of it is pretty minimal. I don't know. It just seems like the visual is so the defining, you know, it's like it's so instructive,
yeah,
you know,
right.
as to whether it's
right.
working or not.
Exactly,
you know?
Absolutely. I totally agree. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I think it would take less for me to stop writing, actually.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I would have to lose any. I wouldn't have to be impaired to stop writing.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I don't necessarily know what would make me stop writing, but sometimes I don't think it would take much.
Really? Really? Have you ever had like a writer's block or something for?
Yeah,
oh,
all the
hi.
Time.
Really?
Hi, Ami.
And it's not just from lack of time or lack of.
No, I think it's, I mean, yeah, I never have time, but I create a situation in which I never have time.
Right.
You know, I think by now I know that it's not just happening to me.
Yeah.
it's, I'm creating these situations, I'm promoting them.
Yeah.
Somehow because, some, well, sometimes, not always, but I think, you know, there's just this sense of, like, overload. Like, there's just too much shit everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
We just bombard, like, there's so much. Like,
mm-hmm.
like why keep going sometimes? I do know that if I don't do it, I lose my mind. I don't
right,
know. I
that's
don't
right,
know where
right,
I stand.
Exactly.
I don't know what I'm thinking. I don't know who I am. I don't. Like, I need to take in and then process and put something back out. If it's all about just taking in outside stimuli, I go nuts. So, for that very simple narcissistic, I mean, or yeah, self-involved reason, I just need to do it. Just for
I like
that.
Your narcissism changes. I was like, this is New York.
Yeah. And then if it happens that what I'm putting out there is actually liked by other people, then that's really awesome. But I don't know. Sometimes, you know, I wonder, like, could I contribute more to society if I were a chef or a talk show host? No, that's awful. I won't see myself doing that. But or a journalist? Like, what if I were just a journalist? I don't know. I mean, I'm not. See, this is a problem. I feel like poetry and I have a very contentious relationship.
What? Really?
Yeah.
This is super shocking.
Totally. We hate each other sometimes. We really hate each other.
Wow.
I don't think poetry hates me as actively as I hate it sometimes. It's bad.
Yeah.
No, it's really bad. And then I feel like, you know, I feel like it's like, in Spanish we have this phrase like, tocó bailar con la más fea. Like, if you were, I mean, and you, like, no, but ya bailó con la más fea. It's like you're doomed. Like, you've got the ugliest dancing partner. Sometimes that's how I feel about poetry.
Yeah.
That I, you know, I feel like poetry has that quality sometimes.
Yeah.
I mean, sorry. I don't mean it. I don't ever see other people's poetry in this light. I'm only speaking from my relationship with
really?
Poetry. No, I love, you know, like when I love poetry, I love it. Love it.
Right.
I'm so passionate about it.
Yes.
I adore it. I have no doubts about other people's poetry.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the poetry I produce. And the me as a poet, it's like, I don't know. Yeah. There's this artist who I love,
mm-hmm.
Marcel Brotiers. I'm probably mispronouncing his name. I never know exactly how to pronounce his name, but he was a poet and then he became a visual artist.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I'll ever become a visual artist because I don't have the ability at all, but his first work of visual art was to buried his book of poems.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. He buried it.
In the backyard next to it.
Yeah, no, and then there was this like a coffin. It was like that was it. And
wow.
Then he just made visual work that actually is really poetic, but
yeah.
That kind of resonates a little bit. I'm not terrible.
I've been thinking a lot about like sitting through poetry readings, and I feel like it's very painful sometimes.
It's
like
painful.
We've been doing them in my house, and it's just been really nice for a lot of, like, personally, just because I don't have to get a sitter and I can chill at home.
Yeah.
But also, I just feel like there's a different vibe when it's in the home space and it's people who really care about each other. I don't want to go back out there. Like,
right.
I'm just like, I don't. For, like, the gems that you see and the moments
yeah.
of, like, transcendence, I feel like there's so much crap. And I'm
right.
just like, I feel like it's very, I don't feel like it's terrible at all what you're saying. I feel like it's very generous, or it's my like hate for the poetry world. It's like, thank God I can like write a poem because my brain will feel better. But like, make them stop. Like, saying them after they write them.
And the thing I hate is like this idea that like just basically it's like axiomatic thinking. Poets tend to be self-righteous. Poets tend to be very self-righteous, righteous about the act of writing poetry and poetry, right? So it's like, oh, just because it's a poem or just because you're a poet doesn't mean that this is relevant, that you need to keep on doing it, that it has any role or benefit to anyone other than you. So just let's please abandon that idea that just because it's poetry, it's good. It's like, this moral superiority that poetry and poets claim is disgusting to me.
Yeah.
I also think that in a way, like maybe this is an important battle to wage because it's not only about our own dislike of particular poets or formats, but it's, I mean, yeah, poetry is something to challenge and to be critical of, and so like poetry should be able to take this very ambivalent relationship with it. And perhaps out of that poking and that like battle with it and that examination, something really interesting comes out.
Yeah.
But if you just go into it without, I just don't think, like I feel the same way about painters. Like if you're a painter in this day and age, you probably have a very ambivalent relationship to your medium because it's constantly being belittled. So out of that struggle, I'm sure something interesting, worthwhile comes out. But to pretend like it's just great because you wrote it, or it's great because it's poetry and it has this intrinsic value because it's not prosaic or whatever, that's crap. I don't believe that at all.
Yeah, no. Well, and I also think there is this amazing freedom that I feel like we just don't exploit enough with poetry.
Right.
Like, where you are, like, that this person is actually just making poems in the form of visual art, you know?
Yeah.
And that,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
As poets, like, how exciting it is. Like, I don't know, I kind of feel like, Bob Holman is someone who does this, like, his energy and enthusiasm about his project is kind of the poetry, you know? And I'm like, I'm always like, I don't know exactly what you're doing, but, like, you're doing it with such, like, poetic panache that, like, we'll go with it. Like, it's great. You know, like,
that's,
I don't know.
So,
and I feel
true.
Like,
you're so right.
The summer I first moved to New York, I read Mary Baraka's, Hetty Jones's, and Diane DePrima's memoir all within the same month, and I was just like, wow, and kind of like rubbing buildings to see if some of that would rub off on me. And I don't know, it's also a little sad because I feel like I missed out.
I don't think it's over, and I think of all these different communities like Ugly Duckling or you know, Future Poem. I mean, I'm very engaged with a lot of different communities, and I feel like, but I also have always had problems with groups.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's ironic, but I always feel like I'm a weird, like, odd bird. Like, I'm always like, I'm here, I'm part of it, but I'm also not really part of it because I actually have this other identity that I kind of wear on my sleeve, so people know that I'm here, but I'm not here. You know, I'm speaking in English, I write in English, I'm an American poet, but you know, I'm really Mexican. So,
yeah.
You know, so I always have these like othering strategies, and that in a way is like, if I had been 20 in 1970, I would have felt exactly the same way around
the
poetry project. I would have been like, oh, what? So now, like, oh, so now we're all going to the party at Bob Holman's, or like, we all must follow Ann Waldman.
Yeah.
Or like, band around Ted Berrigan or whatever. Like, I think,
you're
know,
right, you're
it's
totally
like,
right. Yes.
Yeah. So I think in a way, yeah, those dynamics are still happening around us, and 20 years from now or 30, we'll be able to see them more clearly in a way, or more clearly and maybe more fictionally, because this amorphous mess that we're in right now will lend itself more to self-mythologizing.
Yeah, it'll
right?
be reduced to these like shiny moments of
exactly.
sequence, as opposed to like, oh, I have to get up and do get some printer ink. Like.
Right.
But before you discovered these different communities, did you believe in the myth of this poetic New York that was somehow unattainable or provoked a
nostalgia for something you hadn't experienced before? Or
yeah,
you
yeah,
did.
Way,
okay.
Yeah, I did have that because, especially not so much with the New York because I wasn't that familiar with what had happened here when I first moved here.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other nice thing about New York is that most people. You know, most people came from somewhere else,
mm-hmm.
in a way. And with most people of your generation, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you all kind of land here.
Yeah, I didn't know what had
right,
happened here either. Right,
exactly, but you're
yeah.
not... Right, then you become aware of it. Oh, there was a community here.
Yeah.
You know. But in Mexico, I didn't study poetry. I studied political science. I majored
mm-hmm.
in political science. And all the writers and poets went to UNAM, the public university. And my father didn't allow me to go there because it was on strike when
oh.
I graduated from high school. And so he was like, over my dead body, you're not going there. It was on strike for 2 years, so he had a point. Because nobody was studying for 2 years. So he was right in a way. But I always had this nostalgia for what I thought was the profile of any Mexican intellectual writer worth their salt.
Right.
And it's like they all went to UNAM, they hung out at these cafes, they knew all these people, and I never felt like I was part of them.
Part of that.
So to this day, like, and Bolaño kind of hits on that. Like,
mm-hmm.
the
right,
Savage
right.
Detective.
Yeah.
I feel like that he gets that so well,
mm-hmm.
even though it's prior to when I was around. But I read that book and it just. It's devastating because it's exactly what I fantasized about. It's that group of people and those that lifestyle and those readings and stuff. It's really cool. But yeah, I mean, I think if I lived in Mexico City,
mm-hmm.
I'd also be going like, oh no, please, no, not that reading again.
Right, yeah.
Or why would I want to go to La Covadonga, you know, which
yeah.
is this bar where everyone goes in Mexico City. And it's like, oh no, again El Covadonga on a Thursday night.
Right.
Or I'd be sitting there and I'd be like, oh, there goes Padanelli. You know?
Yeah.
Padanelli is this fiction writer who's always around. He always has a posse around him. And he's like this like wannabe beat writer and he's always drunk and doing tons of drugs and he's surrounded by all these sycophants. And I'd be like, oh no, Padanelli, I'm not going there because, you know. So
right.
It's the same thing. I like my outsider status.
Yes.
I protect it. Yes.
We must.
Hey. Say what? Yo, sometimes I feel like I don't have a partner. Sometimes I feel like my only friend is the city I live in.
Real place. settled by the Dutch many years ago. 3 billion strong, and here we go.
En el borde de la vida y la muerte, nos vamos bailando la suerte de este pobre corazón.
De piedra de ser la cama, de piedra la cabecera, la mujer que a mí me quiera. Me ha de querer día de veras, ay, ay, corazón, ¿por qué no amas?
Subí a la sala del crimen, le pregunté al presidente. Quererte.
Que me sentencie a la muerte, ay, corazón, ¿por qué no amas?
El día que a mí me mate, que sea de 5 balazos y estar cerquita de ti. Y escriban solo.